Aloha, and welcome to Town Square. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. Some say you have to grow into classical music. Others say that's also true for the standards that fill the American songbook. If you tune in to Fascinating Rhythm every weekend, you might agree. Tonight, I sit down with the show's host, Michael Lasser. And as we've had to record this show to make the conversation possible, the phone lines are unavailable. From Hoppe Holly tunes to the ones generations worldwide keep rediscovering, we'll hear the stories of the romance, sly wit, and the craft of the songs that really get to you. And as good as the stories are in the songs, even better are the stories behind the songs. Michael Lasser has a never-ending stream. Michael Lasser, welcome to Town Square.
Hi, Beth Ann. How are you?
I'm doing okay. I wanted to talk to you about the music of Hawaii.
Sure.
A lot of people became acquainted with some of that through Hawaii Calls. I mean, when you've got a show that's running from 1935 to 75, you've got a lot of years, you know, four decades worth, where you can get some of that music out. Did any of that really register as being part of the American songbook or have any cross-pollination with it?
Well, the degree to which it's authentic is something that people in Hawaii are going to know a lot more about than I do. But it's pretty clear that it played a role in American music at various times in the first half of the 20th century. There were times when it became a fad. In the years around World War I, I think is probably when the first fad was, and the songs were mainly comic. That is, any time in those years when you sang about sex, you either disguised it through indirection, or you said it was a kiss, for example, when clearly the song demonstrated that this was much more than a kiss, or you dealt with it comically. There's a song called "They're Wearing Them Haya in Hawaii," and it's a buyer for a fashion company who goes to Hawaii to get ideas for clothing, and he wires back to the company that the grass skirts are getting even shorter. And so they're wearing them haya in Hawaii. And that's the source of the joke.
Henry Meyer was a buyer, buying ladies' wear. He took a flyer to Hawaii, started fashions there. One day Meyer got a wire, hurry back, it read. He wrote, I'm busy, I'm getting dizzy, the styles here turn my head. You'd say the same if you were here with me. Is not the only pretty sight that you can see. In Hawaii, the maidens never tire. They'll simply sway your heart away. Hula maids are always full of pageant. All the old men, they have to watch their step. For they're wearing them higher in Hawaii. They're going up.
Remember that songs are very short. They only run about 3 minutes because they're 32 bars long. They have to fit on one side of a 78 RPM record. And so you have to make your point quickly and get out. And so the comic songs are one joke and out. And so these are sexy little jokes because it was not a time when you would talk directly about sex in something that was going to be public. And so those are the ones from then. But then again in the 30s, Bing Crosby made some movies that were set in Hawaii, and there were movies set in tropical paradises in the 30s and then again in the 40s. The ones in the 40s were also in South America because there was a lot of interest in Latin America in the 40s, the Good Neighbor Policy in the 30s, and then protecting the Panama Canal in World War II. There was a movie with Alice Faye called A Weekend in Havana during the war.
Wow.
You get on the ship and go off to sail to Havana. I mean, it's pure fantasy. It's fairy tale. But the songs have a tropical feel. They're about the islands. And Crosby in the 30s had a huge hit with a song called Blue Hawaii, which featured steel guitars and that sort of accompaniment. and he crooned a song about finding true love beneath palm trees. Dorothy L'Amour in her sarong, that sort of thing. And so it was out there, and it had its effect at these moments in American popular song, but it was never central. It was always peripheral.
Didn't Bing Crosby also have a version of Sweet Leilani?
Yes, he did. Yep. The two big ones were Blue Hawaii and Sweet Leilani, and they were at almost the same time, mid-30s. Easy enough, I happen to be sitting by my computer, and while I'm talking, I am typing in Blue Hawaii, 1937. And I'll bet Sweet Leilani was at exactly the same time. In fact, I think it's the same movie, a movie called Waikiki Wedding. What more could you want?
Certainly no more than that, given how many songs revolve around love and sex. You talk about that they're only 32 bars long, 3 minutes, had to fit on one side of a record. I mean, for a lot of people, the idea of a record is somewhere back there, even knowing now that CDs are moving their way out as most of us download music.
Before we could have records, we had to have invented the wheel, so it's not quite that old. But 78 RPM records come in the years before World War One, and the 78 RPM record, which is one song on each side, the record going around at 78 revolutions per minute on a turntable, and they were what there was until 1949, when Columbia introduced the LP, the long playing record, which gave you up to a half hour on each side. And it was revolutionary because it meant, for example, that you could perhaps record an entire concerto on one piece of plastic.
Or an entire album that takes you through many different moods. So if you don't like this song, maybe you'll like something else.
Yeah, there were albums of 78 RPM records, but they were big and clunky and heavy because it would be what amounted to a book. And in it, there would be slots instead of pages. And in each slot, there would be a record. If you had four records, you had eight songs.
And you had a change of them all.
Yes, and then they developed record players that had changers. So at the end of the recording's music, the arm that had the needle in it would lift and swing back, and the next one would drop down, and then the arm would go back and drop the needle down into the first groove.
So, I mean, things got better, and it got maybe easier to listen to a lot of music at once. But when these one-song records came out and had to get to their point pretty quickly, as you say, that also in some ways means that people got some really good lyrics and witty, fun things that now we can only wish for.
Well, we don't live in a time that prizes wit, to be gentle about it. I'm old, so I'm being crotchety, but it's quite true. I was listening to a song the other day. I went to the movies, and this song was playing while they showed me all the ads that I refused to read. And it was, I don't remember what it was saying, but it was the same line over and over and over again. And I'm a smart guy. I understood it the first time. Somebody wants to have sex with somebody else. The man who was singing kept saying something like, "I want to spend the night with you, baby." And he said it over. And I assumed that she eventually went to bed with him just to get him to
shut up. Well, I mean, that's part of modern criticism about a lot of modern music, not all. I mean, some of it tries to develop a sense of social consciousness or talk about issues that particularly are acute if you're 20-something or in your teens. But for that same age group listening to these songs, there was no less attention being paid to sex or to love. It was just how it was being done and with what kind of wit.
One of the amazing things that the song lyricists in the period that we're talking about, which is the Great American Songbook between 1900 and 1950, roughly. 1950 is useful because very soon rock and roll will come along and pretty much end it. And 1900 is useful because jazz and ragtime are shaping the songbook and replacing the sentimental ballad of the 19th century. So the timing makes sense, even though you don't draw two lines. You know, when people say this period goes from this year to this year, it's a convenience. rather than, it's a simplification. What the Great American Songbook gives us is a sense of melody, first of all, a rich sense of melody. And melody is largely gone today. Rap and the music that precedes it pretty much reduce melody to rhythm. And the rhythms may be intricate and may be varied and they may even be interesting, but they're not in the service of a larger entity, which is melody. Rhythm drives melody. It's not an end in itself, and it's become an end in itself because you dance to it, but you've always danced to the rhythm in the melody. That's hardly new. So that these songwriters had a keen sense of melody because they'd learned syncopation from ragtime, they've learned from jazz, they've learned from the blues. These are the composers. So melody plus rhythm. And the rhythms get pretty intricate and pretty innovative at the hands of George Gershwin, for example. And then the lyricists come along, and what they do is they give this new sound that's both romantic and jazzy, both. That's not supposed to go together. You give it to someone like Harold Arlen, and boy, it sure does. They bring to it a new kind of writing that's rooted not in literary language, not in beautiful dreamer, wake unto me, Stephen Foster's beautiful song from the 19th century. But you can't imagine yourself saying that. It's not speech. And now suddenly we get something that comes to be called the conversational lyric. What songwriters discover is American speech. These are the lyricists now. And they lift it to the level of song. They make it serve the purposes and the subject matter and the themes of popular music. And so what they learn how to do is write songs that feel both witty and sentimental. That is, they're emotional, but they're also witty. And the achievement there doesn't sound like a big deal, but it really is, because sentiment, emotion, requires that you be up close, that you be engaged. It's emotion, after all. Whereas wit requires that you lean back and take a sharp look, an honest look at what's there in front of you. Love can distort, but wit tells you the truth. The emperor has no clothes on. And to make the two of them work in the same song is quite remarkable.
Which is one of the reasons why you talked about Harold Arlen a little earlier. Come Rain and Come Shine is still a favorite song because it gets to that point of wanting to stay with someone forever. And why?
Yeah, but if you say that Harold Arlen wrote that song, then you only get to hum it because he didn't write the words. He wrote only the melody. With very few exceptions, Cole Porter, Irving Berlin, a few others, almost all of them were written by collaborators. They were written by a composer. 90% of the time, he did his work first. And then the lyricist set words to the music.
Well, I still hum it. I still love it.
Yeah, but you got to give credit to the lyricist.
Oh, absolutely. It wouldn't be anything. I mean, that's why so many people pick some of these songs and play them at weddings and certainly anniversaries, because they're able to capsulize in such a small period of time, such great emotion and feelings that for a lot of people are difficult to be able to say.
And they create a character. They create a dramatic situation in which the emotion comes alive. And in this case, so if you love that song, if you love Come Rain or Come Shine, and it's a magnificent song, then it's not a Harold Arlen song. It's a Harold Arlen, Johnny Mercer
song, yeah. Okay, I'm corrected.
There are people talk about Gershwin songs. There's no such thing as a Gershwin song, unless you want to hum.
Right.
Because George Gershwin wrote ta-da-da-dee-da-da-da-dum. Ira Gershwin wrote, But Oh My Dear, Our Love Is Here to Stay.
Mm-hmm.
Harold Arlen wrote da 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 da, and Yip Harburg wrote Somewhere Over the Rainbow. And together they make a song.
In preparation for talking to you, I had mentioned at a party that I was going to have this conversation and just sort of ask someone about the Great American Songbook. And I said, how would you define it? And a friend leaned over and said, well, you know, those are all the songs they just don't write anymore.
They never did.
No, that's what I was going to ask you.
Yeah.
Is this really sort of a myth, or is it really true that we don't have people writing songs like this anymore with this kind of wit, romance, fun, and cleverness.
And melody.
And melody all wrapped up together.
Yeah. Well, what we don't have is that combination of wit and sentiment. What we don't have is that strong sense of melody. What we don't have is the inventiveness of the lyrics. And look, there are always great songwriters out there. Whether they appeal to you and me is a matter of personal taste, but there are always good songwriters. John Lennon and Bob Dylan come after the period that I'm interested in, that I think is the remarkable time. But were they great songwriters? Of course they were. Stephen Foster in the 19th century was a great songwriter. The guy who wrote Yankee Doodle was a great songwriter. But during this period, the first half of the 20th century, just in terms of quantity, you get more remarkable songwriters all at the same time. You know, it's one of those accidental moments. You know, how come such and such happened at such and such a time? Because there were more great baseball players or more great poets or more great scientists or more great whatever, shoelace designers. And so there's this great burst of achievement. And that happens in the first half of the 20th century. Without even thinking, Jerome Kern, Oscar Hammerstein, Richard Rodgers, Lorenz Hart, Ira Gershwin, George Gershwin, Irving Berlin, Cole Porter, Johnny Mercer, Harold Arlen, and that's without thinking, all working at the same time, all at the height of their powers. And so in the sense your friend is right, but it needs some unpacking.
Well, even just the fact that we see so many singers who will, at a certain point in their career, do a standards album, as if somehow they have arrived, sort of makes me want to ask you whether the American Songbook is something into which you need to age and have enough understanding to be able to really see how incredible all of it really is and understand why we don't have that happening in the same way today.
It wasn't that way originally, because this was the popular music people grew up on. But I think that's a fair way to put it now. Whispering the other side of the coin, so many of the people who go back and try to sing it do it so badly.
You mean like Rod Stewart?
Oh, please. And even worse, the opera singers who try to cross over and do it. I'm thinking when I become emperor of the world, I may have to pass a law against that one.
But Natalie Cole did a pretty good job, right, with Unforgettable? Mm-hmm. Natalie Cole?
Yeah, but she grew up on it.
Yeah, that's the difference.
That's the difference. But they have no feel for it. They're making sounds. They heard somebody's record, and so they're, in effect, imitating it. It may not be slavish imitation, but they don't really have a feel. Every now and then you get somebody who does. Eileen Farrell, the opera singer, could do it. Frederica von Stade, of all people, can do it, because she's just an American kid who happens to sing opera. Dawn Upshaw can do it. Willie Nelson can do it. Unfortunately, a lot of singers who, when they bring their own styles to these songs, don't have the critical distance or the critical closeness to be able to say, no, I can't do that here. This won't work. I need to sing this one straight. Just think about what people do to the Star Spangled Banner. When they bring in a singer to do the Star Spangled Banner, I want to go hide under the seat.
Well, yeah, most people do, especially when notes start appearing that were never, ever there in the first place and they don't belong.
Well, because they don't sing the song. They turn the song into them.
Right. That's the point. You know, yeah.
I'm very old-fashioned. I think singers serve songs as much as songs serve singers. And it's not that way anymore.
So having said that, sort of is quite a pronouncement, both what you said and certainly what my friend said about they don't write songs like that anymore. How do we begin to help a younger generation approach the Great American Songbook, given how they've grown up and where they're coming from, which is vastly different from even where, say, our parents came from when there was still some of that music around as the transition to rock was happening?
Well, first of all, you're not going to get people, especially young people, to turn their backs on the music of their own time. First of all, it's futile. And second of all, every age has parents tut-tutting about their kids' music. It's in our DNA.
Right, but that's different from being able to just expose to something else that's out there. I mean, my uncle who took me to hear opera for the first time or played, you know, Barber's Adagio for strings and said to me, Beth Ann, do you want to hear the angels sing? Suddenly made me aware that there was something else out there.
Well, one of the ways you do that is through taking kids to musicals. And I don't mean Andrew Lloyd Webber, because no matter what, I would never mean Andrew Lloyd Webber about anything, unless you're a great fan of bombast. But there are revivals constantly of old musicals. Annie, Get Your Gun, My Fair Lady, doesn't matter. Because when parents take young people to this, they take their 9-year-old kids and the daughters are wearing their Mary Janes and off they go and they love it. And even if they drag a sulky teenager, so I apologize for the redundancy, even if they drag a
Remember, you're talking to the mother of three boys, right?
A sulky teenager, if the performance is any good, it will probably work its way on them. And they won't walk out and suddenly become enamored of Lerner and Lowe and Rodgers and Hammerstein and the Gershwins, but they will have made room in the part of their head that listens to music for this. You don't expect it to sweep away everything else. All you ask is that it become part of the mix. And one of the ways you do that is by exposing kids, understanding that when they're adolescent, they'll probably turn their backs on it because that's what adolescents do, and may, if they're lucky, find their way back to it as they get a little older. Just as the singers work their way back to it, so do the audiences.
When they're working their way back to it, is there something that you have seen over the years that tends to draw them in first? Is it those romantic lyrics?
Oh, sure. You know, first of
trying
all,
to impress a girl.
I think it's the sense of melody. I don't even think they know it's happening to them. But I think we all respond to melody on some deep level. And so even if we've grown up with something like rap, where it is so reliant on rhythm, even there, when we come to melody, it may sound hokey to us, but it's also on another level working on us. Exposure short of the horsewhip makes it happen. You know, having a chance to hear someone like Michael Feinstein, who is, I think, a much truer singer of these songs, I think he really comes to the heart of these songs. He gets it, even though he's today a man of only 50. For years, he's come close to it. He's had a sense of what those songs are and how they work and what they say and is able to convey that through his singing. It's out there, and it's just a matter of exposure and infinite patience.
Do you see anybody writing in any of these styles today? Is there anything modern that we can point to and say, see, it's not just something from
long
ago?
Hard to point to, but yes, it's happening. You see it in the kinds of songs that good cabaret singers follow. Well, you know, take a song like Billy Joel's New York State of Mind. I can't see myself going to a Billy Joel concert because a lot of what he performs would not be of great interest to me. But New York State of Mind is a great song, a wonderful song. It's an iconic song, along with both New York, New Yorks. There are two of them. And a lot of others, As Time Goes By, and Stardust, and Love Is Here to Stay, and Always, they're iconic songs. And New York State of Mind belongs on that list, regardless of when it was written. The great singers who work in cabarets and help to keep this music alive, they're in large cities and they're in small clubs and they draw sophisticated audiences, at least still. Who knows what that will be like in 20 years, if they will still be sophisticated audiences. And they keep the songs alive and they find new examples of them and they help to promote them by singing them. And that's what you hope for. But is any one of those songs ever going to become a hit? And is a mass audience ever going to suddenly embrace it and buy a million copies of it? No, that's not going to happen.
You brought up New York State of Mind, which I remember my parents playing over and over again because it was such an incredibly evocative song. That sense of both hopefulness and melancholy that seemed to mix made it listenable again and again. But that was like the middle 70s.
Yeah. But again, there are still songwriters out there who are writing this stuff, and for a small coterie of singers and their relatively small audience. But it's there. It's still alive.
Which is to say that perhaps it's not going to be as big in our minds or in the public consciousness in the way that the Great American Songbook is. And
well,
maybe that's okay?
These are the latter-day expressions of that songbook.
Right, but it's not going to be out there in such a public
way in
the way that the songbook itself was, because that was, as you said before, the popular music of the day. This is now something that is so rarefied and sophisticated that only people who are truly drawn to it are going to go find it, or who will hopefully expose their kids to it, and that will keep it going, but at a different level.
No question, at a different level.
And that's not necessarily a bad thing.
No, and I'm old enough that I don't have to care about that, because I can continue to listen to what I want to listen to, and when I'm no longer here, it's somebody else's problem.
Okay, so let's say that's my problem. Let's say
that's
my kid's problem. I mean, there are those of us who have really aged into this music and love it, and will play different renditions of it again and again and enjoy some of it. But because this is sort of our problem, any of us who like this music, who are trying to find this music, figuring out who's doing it now, that's always going to be somewhat a matter of a one-directional thing. I don't think this is going to come at us in the way that it came at others, our parents and our grandparents, just because it was there. So if we've got to go find it, where do we look? Where do we look for this, aside from going on Google and trying to find who's doing what?
Well, for Google and iTunes, obviously. But you have to go to iTunes and look, because when you go to iTunes, the thing that they splash at you is what was released this morning, because they're trying to sell it. The exposure to performance, I think, is key. To musicals, to cabarets. And the problem with cabaret is it only exists in large cities, and it's expensive. There's no easy answer here. There's recordings or downloads, but you've got to know what to look for. And one way to find that out is to read my books. I wondered how I was going to work that in, and I thank you for the setup.
And I didn't even know I was giving it to you,
that's
so lucky you.
But
that
time.
Goes to a point, though, of getting some education about this, because it's not just, it was the popular music of the 1900s through the early 50s, and then it saw some other strains that resurged in the 60s and 70s and beyond, as we've talked about. But understanding this in a way that goes beyond just, sort of sonic wallpaper.
I'll tell you one thing you're up against. Music has always had a social function, popular music. And I don't mean that it was written to this purpose at all. Not at all. It wasn't. But the way in which it's functioned in the culture is one of the things I'm interested in. And I think you can say that when I was growing up in the 40s and went to college, got married in the 50s, that music, the music of the 20s, 30s, the war years, joined the generations. That is, every generation knew songs the other generation didn't. My parents knew stuff from the 20s that I never heard of. But if you got three or four generations around a piano, they could spend a couple of hours all singing the same song.
That makes me think of the fact that we live here in Hawaii, where we have the largest population of multi-generational households. I wonder if that puts us in better stead for understanding some of these songs.
Well, I don't know, because I think what's happened since is that now songs don't connect the generations. They define the generations. I was once talking to a woman who was complaining about, she was younger than I, she was complaining about the stuff her son listened to loudly. And I really didn't want to hear it. And so I said, why don't you just tell him to turn it down? And that was fine. She didn't object to that. But then I really put my foot in my mouth. And I said, besides, how different can it be from what you listen to? Well, that.
Then you got an earful.
not an earful. I'm 6'4", and she must have been 5'1". And she drew herself up, and she looked me in the eye, and she said, please, I'm Springsteen, and I had been put in my place. And I've seen people try to get together to sing together with different ages, and they have great difficulty doing it because they don't know the same songs anymore. Those are legitimate differences. That is, songs to connect people, songs to define people. Those are perfectly legitimate functions socially of music in a culture. But I like the first much better, personally, for two reasons. One, it's what I grew up on, so I like it better. That's just personal. But in a country as unlikely, you know, this should not be the United States of America. This should be the Balkans. We should be fighting each other. Only once did we really fight one another. And anything that bridges, anything that connects short of the illegal or the immoral is to the good. And the fact that something as small and innocuous, as temporary as a song, as most songs anyway, can do that for us for an evening, I find very pleasing to think about.
And that's sort of why I brought up this issue of multi-generational households. Because on this end,
but they may all have been listening to different songs.
Well, different and some of the same, because we are, many of us, living with our grandparents or our parents, depending upon what ages we may be, the traditions of music in Hawaii and the way we will get together and sing and play and just listen and enjoy seems to be a little bit different. I'm wondering
if it
might be somebody's PhD thesis to come out and ask
it. Just hit me as you were talking. Did you ever watch the 4th of July concert on television at the National Mall?
Oh, of course.
D.C.? We all have. We've all watched it. And at one point, everybody there gets to sing patriotic songs while the orchestra plays. And they flash the words on the screen. So if you don't know My Country, 'Tis of Thee, or God Bless America, well, first of all, shame on you. But if you don't, you can sing in your living room if you want to. Meanwhile, the camera is panning around the audience. And it's this huge sing-along. There are thousands of people of every age, in every kind of dress, fitting every stereotype you could ever think of. And they're all singing together. They're all singing God Bless America. There it is. That's what I'm talking about.
And we have precious few occasions to be able to really do that now, because so much of what we do and how we entertain ourselves isn't done in real time. You can listen to whatever you want to listen to at whatever hour you want to listen to it by going online, obviously, the podcasting.
Alas.
Of that. And that has changed the consciousness of a collective experience.
Yeah, we've gained things, obviously, but I think we've lost something profound and two things. One, ironically, they're diametrically opposed. On one hand, we've lost this sense of comity. And on the other hand, we've thrown away, the young have anyway, the sense of privacy, and they won't know they've lost it until they go to find it and find they don't have it anymore. And I will have no sympathy for them at all. That's something I'm unforgiving about.
And a lot of people are, and yet it's the culture that they and those that come after them will have to cope with. And I wonder how that's going to turn up in music and whether that's going to move us further and further away from anything that resembles the Great American Songbook.
Well, it could very well. And the irony in all this, it's fairly gentle, but I'm fond of it, is that the song we all know and the one we love the best is an American popular song written by our greatest songwriter, Irving Berlin. God Bless America.
It's kind of interesting to step back a little bit and wonder if that will be the song that we will love the best a little later on.
We already do. I mean, nobody wants to sing the Star Spangled Banner because it's unsingable.
That's one reason, unless, of course, you just invent notes along the way, but we talked about that. But as we go into the future, looking at how future generations and kids now who are small will look at God Bless America, and maybe that will be their entry ticket into the Great American Songbook in some ways.
Well, they're going to have to be shown how it is. That is, giving somebody a ticket doesn't tell him what train to get on. You got to say, go down there and turn left.
Which is to say that there will still be people who hopefully will love the Great American Songbook enough to want to introduce others to it.
Because I really do think it's, a friend of mine calls it America's classical music. And I think there's something to that. It's the music that will persist. Again, some John Lennon will persist, some Bob Dylan will persist. But there are still millions of people in this country, and I mean millions, it wouldn't surprise me, somewhere between 5 and 10 million people, who could sing for you right now every word to Alexander's Ragtime Band, which was written in 1911, as a popular song.
And we'd ask them to come on along. Yes, okay, you made your point.
Yeah, it's in our DNA.
Well, especially when it's catchy and it starts to wrap itself around your brain, there are times when you can't get rid of it even if you wanted to.
When my son, when he was a little boy, and he couldn't get a song out of his head, you know the way that drives you crazy?
Yeah, I do.
Used to say he had a song headache.
Beautiful.
I think it's a great line. He was probably 5 or 6 when he said that. And song headaches are wonderful things because they remind us of things we know and like. I've been having one several days now. A song by Irving Berlin has been playing around in my head. It's not one of his most famous, but it is in the second book called All By Myself. And the lines that keep running, it's a sad song, but it's also quite rhythmic. It's got bounce. And the lyric at one point, he's bemoaning the future, getting old alone. And the simplicity of it is wonderful. If I long to rest my weary head on somebody's shoulder, I hate to grow older all by myself.
And it poignantly expresses how many people who are in love and have been in love for a lifetime feel.
Yeah, but there's also the way it works, the long lyrical line, I long to rest my weary head on somebody's shoulder, and then the punchy line, I hate to grow older. And then the final line that ties it back into the song, because it's the title of the song, All By Myself.
Which sort of brings up another issue that we haven't talked about, the format and the rhyme schemes within a lot of the songs from the Great American Songbook. What's the commonality?
The vast majority of them have the same structure. Do you want to get into structure?
Sure, a little bit, because if we're going to educate, let's do some.
Okay. There's a verse, and then there's the chorus. And the verse has virtually no rules. It can be any length. But rhyme is very important, and for most of the songwriters of the Great American Songbook, exact rhyme is very important. None of this rhyming time with mine.
Yeah, rhyme. No near misses is what you're saying.
I once interviewed Sammy Kahn, the song lyricist, and he asked me to pronounce Y-O-U-R, and I said, your. And then he said, pronounce Y-O-U apostrophe R-E, and I said, your, and he snapped, no, it's your. Get it right. And he was right. I was wrong. It is your. The verse has whatever rules you make up for it. It can be of any length. But then you get to the chorus, and it's usually 4 lines, and it's either an ABAB or an ABCB rhyme scheme. Do I have to explain that to people?
Oh, I don't think so.
Okay. And then there's a second chorus, which is exactly the same melody as in the first chorus, and the same rhyme scheme, but there'll be different rhyme words. That is, if it's moon and spoon in the first chorus that rhyme, the second and fourth lines, then in the second chorus there'll be look and book. And then you have a third four-line sequence that's called the release or the bridge. And that changes the melody. You break away. You're released from that melody that you had in the first chorus and the second chorus. And that's usually a kind of another point of view or a commentary or a different angle on what's happening in the song. And then there's a fourth unit, which goes back to that original melody with that same rhyme scheme. And so a popular song is an A-A-B-A structure preceded by a verse.
With no near misses when it comes to rhyming, it's got to be dead on.
Yep. By the way, a lot of internal rhyming in these songs and a lot of assonance, repetition of sounds inside the line that creates this pattern of sound that keeps you moving. I long to rest my weary head on somebody's shoulder. The eh, those short E sounds help carry you through the line.
Which is where some of the craft comes in and also the wit.
Oh, the craft is wonderful. The craft is extraordinary, and often, yes, the wit is tied up in the craft. You're quite right about that.
Which kind of brings us back to one of your earlier points that, and also the point that my friend makes, is they just don't write songs like this anymore because it's too hard.
Yeah. I was a teacher for 40 years, and some colleagues and I figured out, first of all, we did not tolerate the word boring. It was the one word in class that you could not use. You could say anything else, but you could not use the word boring. And the reason was this. All boring meant is that it was harder than I want to work.
The mother in me is smiling. Yes, I get that one.
So you can tell your kids, you may not say that to me. You can think it. You're free to think anything you want. But every time you think it, you say it, I'm going to let you know what it really means. You're just lazy and running away from a chance to learn something. And you can do that, but I don't have to put up with it.
Is there a corollary to that one that, you know, if you are saying that you are bored, that in fact makes you boring?
Yes. I used to tell my students there is nothing as boring as an adolescent going around saying I'm bored. There's a wonderful song called Lazy that Irving Berlin wrote in 1924. He had been working on a show on Broadway, and it had just opened, and he was pooped. And so he went to Florida to rest up. It was in the 20s that Florida became a big resort. The trains were open and reliable and so on. You could get there. And he went down to Florida and lay on the beach, well, I guess for a week or two, doing nothing. But since he was Irving Berlin, while he was there doing nothing, he wrote a song about doing nothing. Anyway, he was lying in the sand, and he wrote a song called Lazy, and it's got this line in it that I just love. He talks about having brought with him on this vacation a great big valise full of books to read where it's peaceful. Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah, it is, and something that even to this day, whether you call it a valise or a suitcase, many people can still relate.
Absolutely. And even if it's a Kindle, although that removes the weight, and the weight is part of the effect of the line. That is, if you just stick something in your back pocket, it doesn't mean as much as if you have to schlep through a train station and whatever with a big bag full of books, because books get heavy fast.
Yeah, that's sweat equity.
Yeah, exactly. And so while the Kindle gives you the same thing, it's not the same.
Every time I see a puppy upon our summer day, a puppy dog at play, my heart is filled with envy. That's why I'm in such a hurry to pass the time away. Like that puff has an all set up, and though it's wrong to be
guys didn't sit around waiting for inspiration. They worked. Berlin wrote 3,000 songs in his life and published 1,500 of them. Johnny Mercer used to complain because the kids didn't work. They waited for inspiration. You got to work. And so you got up every day and you wrote, and some days it was all garbage. Mercer compared it to playing baseball. Some days you go hitless, but you go back out there the next day and play the game again.
That also seems to feed into one of the themes that's obviously emerging in our conversation over the last little while, of how difficult it is or maybe should be to do something of value, whether it's carrying around a bunch of books that you really want to read or crafting something that's wonderful that people are going to want to listen to for hundreds of years.
I don't think you work any harder than you have to, but I think you have to be prepared to work as hard as you have to. Some days you sit down, you know, the fact that a student, anybody, works hard doesn't mean it's going to go well. And some days you sit down and just knock it off and it's terrific. Hard work is not what it's about. Accomplishment is what it's about. And to say to kids, well, anybody who works hard, if you work hard, you can achieve anything you want, is a lie. It's one of those lies that adults tell their kids and feel morally superior doing it. It's like building self-esteem. It's a kind of lying.
Should then we be telling them simply get it done well?
Yeah. Tell them the truth. We all find our own ways to tell the truth, especially the kids, and you can't just beat on them. But tell them the truth. This is hard, so you're going to have to work harder to learn it.
Sometimes in business, you know, we tell people, I worked a 12-hour day or another 14-hour day, as if that's supposed to confer some sort of, you know, sympathy to that person. And a lot of people say, no, I'm not impressed, because it either means you've got some real problems with time management or you don't know what you're doing.
Maybe you're just a dope.
Yeah.
Maybe you don't belong in this job. You know, the Peter principle is alive and well.
Unfortunately, we see that far too often.
It's not the work. It's the work to a purpose. That's why the people who separate out process drive me crazy. Nobody ever studied the process to study the process. You learn the process so you can do something.
Yeah, and in Hawaii, that has a lot of resonance about how much we're willing to study something and study the process of doing something. A lot of people will see some real parallels in there. But as we're coming down to almost an hour that we've been talking, I wanted to ask you, if there is something after all these years of having done Fascinating Rhythm and trying to let the rest of us know the things that you know, or at least look at the world a little differently, or just be aware of our history, is there something that you wish that we knew better right now?
I wish, this is going to sound silly, I wish everybody knew who Yip Harburg was. I say Irving Berlin, everybody nods. I say George Gershwin, everybody smiles. I say Rodgers and Hammerstein, they hug themselves. I say Yip Harburg, they scratch their heads and look funny. Yip Harburg is one of our major lyricists, and for some reason his name hasn't stuck. He wrote the words to Over the Rainbow, which, by the way, is not somewhere over the rainbow, it's Over the Rainbow. He wrote the words to Brother, Can You Spare a Dime, the Great Depression anthem. He wrote Paper Moon.
Yeah.
He wrote the score to Finian's Rainbow. I mean, this is a great songwriter. I wish people knew Yip Harburg. And if they go online and look up the Harburg Foundation, they can learn something about Yip. He wrote one of the great lines. He wrote some books of light verse in addition to lyrics. And he wrote this. It is one of my little mantras. To let a fool kiss you is stupid. To let a kiss fool you is worse.
There are a lot of women who should have that emblazoned on their foreheads, perhaps.
Isn't that good?
It's still good. And what year was that written?
Oh, probably in the 40s.
Which is to say that some things stay true.
Have you got time for me to tell you a Yip Harburg story?
Oh, we absolutely do.
All right. His son, Ernie, whom I've met, no, just a little, was a clinical psychologist. Ernie today is in his late 80s. And he was married to Dina Rosenberg, who was a professor at the Tisch School of the Arts at New York University, the largest private university in the country, by the way. And Dina founded the musical theater program at the Tisch School. And they used to take, they may still, but they used to take unusual vacations. They didn't go sit on the beach at Waikiki. They went to places like Machu Picchu. And they are somewhere in the Altiplano in South America. You know, they're in Ecuador or Peru, up in the mountains in the backwoods. And they're bouncing down and around on this little bus through mountain roads. And the bus is full with suitcases and goats and God knows what on the bus. Everybody on the bus is singing because they got these long rides. And they're native people. And they adopt Ernie and Dina. And they all speak either Spanish or Quechua, which apparently is still spoken. It's the language of the Incas, spoken in the boonies. Dina is fluent in Spanish, so they're getting along fine. And at one point, Ernie turns to Dina and says, you know, we really ought to sing them an American song. And Dina says, one of yips. So they start singing Over the Rainbow. Within 8 bars, in a variety of languages, everybody on the bus is singing it. They all know it. It's the universal American song, and Yip Harburg and Harold Arlen wrote it.
And now you got me all teary, because for a lot of folks in our end of the world over here, having Brother Iz's version of it mixed with What a Wonderful World has gone around the world and has been so much a part of many soundtracks. It's one of those beautiful stories.
You know, it almost never got done.
Really?
Over the Rainbow. Do you know
really?
The story?
Tell us the story.
Harold Arlen and Yip Harburg wrote the score to The Wizard of Oz. Yip Harburg wrote the words to If I Only Had a Brain and If I Only Had a Heart and We're Off to See the Wizard, and Arlen wrote the music. And they got to the end and they realized they had never written a song for Judy Garland, her character, for Dorothy, who's only 13. But, you know, Garland was 18. In fact, they had to bind her breasts so she could play the part. Arlen writes a melody, and Harburg comes in to hear it, because 90% of these songs were written music first. And that's another whole story we can talk about another day. I think it's a very interesting story about why the music precedes the words. I think most people find that counterintuitive. Anyway, Harburg comes in, and Arlen plays it for him. And sometimes Harold Arlen had a very ornate, very flamboyant style of playing. And he gets all done, and Yip says, play it again. And Harold does, and he said, Harold, I can't write anything to that. And he tries it again, and Yip just can't hear it, because he's played it in this very ornate, flamboyant, florid way. And they separate, and Yip goes home, and he's all upset. And he calls his good friend. They were boyhood friends back in New York. They're out in Hollywood now. Ira Gershwin. They grew up together. In fact, Ira got Yip into lyric writing. And he explains the problem, and Yip says, would you come and listen to the song with me tomorrow? And Ira says, sure. So back they go, and Harold plays it, and Ira's got the same problem. They can't hear the melody in it, because you know, you write to the notes of the melody. And Ira gets a brainstorm, and he says, Harold, whom he called Herschel, Harold, would you play it with one finger, please? And Arlen does, and Yip said, oh, that I can write to.
You know, it's kind of like what we tell kids when they start to write, and all of these prepositional phrases start flowing in, and they're padding,
yep,
padding,
yep,
padding.
Pare it
just
down.
Pare
it
down.
Down.
That's a beautiful story.
Isn't that great? Yeah. What I'd like people to do is go out and learn more about Yip Harburg's songs.
Michael, I wish we had another hour. And maybe in the future we will.
I would love to.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Are blue. that you dare to dream really do come true. Someday I'll wish upon a star and wake up where the clouds are far behind me, where troubles melt like lemon drops away above the chimney tops. That's where you
Michael Lasser is a walking compendium of all things American Songbook, and he's the host of Fascinating Rhythm, heard every Sunday afternoon at 4 on HPR2. His most recent book is America's Songs 2, Songs from the 1890s to the Postwar Years. As a special offer for the Town Square audience, Michael Lasser will inscribe your book if you already have it, or if you don't, you can buy it online and send it to him. All the details are on hpr2.org on the Town Square page. That's the show for tonight. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich, and I'll be back in the studio with you next week, and the phone lines will be waiting for your call to Town Square. See you then.